Good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub here again from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. Again, this is four today or three. I can't remember. I think it's four today. Today is July 10th, Friday. Happy Friday to everybody. And whatever you are, if you already started your afternoon beer, good for you. My guests and I, we still have a few hours to go, but there's a cold one waiting somewhere.
Yeah, speak for yourself.
Maybe if you're not into that, a glass of water or something. I don't know. So the topic of discussion today is we talk a lot about this show about reaching global audiences. Okay, so we talk about getting the right messages to the right people in the right language. What if the real problem isn't translation at all in a lot of cases? What if that most organizations out there are blasting the same message for everyone and hoping for something that sticks? Today's guest has spent two decades studying how people actually make decisions. And he'd built an AI engine trained on over a billion behavioral signals that fixes exactly that gap. His name is Dan Bird. And I think this conversation is going to challenge a few assumptions out there. So I can't wait to dig into it. Dan Bird is the founder and CEO of Wrench.ai, where he's helped more than 65 organizations move from generic outreach to hyper-personalized engagement using psychographic profiling, predictive modeling, and first-party data enrichment. His team has driven engagement increases by 5x and cut acquisition costs by 83%, numbers that are hard to ignore some these days because I come from a sales background. I can tell you the biggest time is being spent right now at the top of the funnel. I think like if you want to do the 80-20 rule, 80% of the effort is spent at the top of the funnel. What I'm personally curious about, Dan, is how neuroscience of trust you keep referring to actually work. How does it show up inside a real AI model? Because that's not a phrase you hear all the time from MarTech companies and MarTech founders. So before any further ado, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat.
Hey, thank you. I am honored, humbled. I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you with me. I really appreciate it. Let's start with the easy one. What's your story? What got you here? Who you are? How did you get here? Give us the story.
I'm a third generation entrepreneur and I like building stuff. I would argue at this point, it's fair to say it's genetic. My dad is a builder. He built motorcycles, cars, and a plane in our garage when I was a kid. And I've kind of followed in suit. I just built a car with him outside here, a little cool little Cobra, little Shelby Cobra thing. And when I was in college, co-built one of my first companies called Lovesack, big beanbag chairs. You've probably seen them in retail malls. It's a public company now. That was fun. Took that and went and built new products for ConAgra. So I studied, I studied argumentation and decision making. That was the name of my bachelor's degree. I've only met one other person that ever got it.
Never heard of it, to be honest with you. First time.
One thing I would really suggest, some of the better advice I've ever gotten in my life, I was sitting down looking, trying to figure out what to do with my life. My mom sat down with like the it kind of was like a, you know, like a program, if you will, for all of the courses that the school offered. And she just went, go through and circle all the ones you really like. And we reverse engineered the degree. It happened to be argumentation and decision making, but ended up being one of the better decisions of my life because I love the psychology of people, how they make decisions, how they think, how they do decisioning. And so that degree was all about negotiation, interviewing, persuasion techniques, all that fun stuff. And I love that stuff. And I ended up being one of the only people that uses their bachelor's degree. So I use it all day, every day. I would argue everyone else does too. So fascinating with humans and building stuff. When I went and worked at ConAgra, they are, you know, big company. They own Healthy Choice and Orville Redenbacher and a bunch of those brands. I sat behind a lot of one-way glass watching how people interacted with products. And my job was to figure out how to get them to buy more of them. How do you, like, what is the magic word that you need to say to get someone to buy a different type of popcorn type stuff? Still, for me, fascinating. I loved it because they would literally sit and tell us how they made decisions. That was kind of the basis of Wrench. When we did that, I found that there were a ton of tools, techniques, methods, and stuff like that that all kind of worked. And I also saw that a ton of companies didn't use them. So Wrench was an attempt to go, there's a bunch of digital exhaust out there, publicly available data, LinkedIn profiles, everything else. You can actually use that to do a lot in understanding how to communicate with someone. And what most people don't know, you mentioned sales earlier. Some of the highest performing salespeople ask the most questions. It's one of the more definitive indicators of the highest performing salespeople is they actually ask more questions, meaning they adapt their pitch to their audience, right? I would argue one of the biggest mistakes and myths that people use in sales is they talk about that elevator pitch. Here's my perfect 30-second. What happens is that's usually the one that they like the most, not the one their audience likes. And so through these and all these kind of experiences, watching how people behave, make decisions and everything, we studied and we built Wrench AI, which is basically an AI platform that uses data decision-making methodology. It's not just an LLM wrapper. This is machine learning, this is statistical analysis rules and LLMs all wrapped together to basically answer the question of who do you talk to, what do you say, and how do you say it? And the methods that we use on that are combined in stuff that you thought of and things like segmentation with demographic analysis. Are they in the right location at the right company and all that fun stuff? But also you can actually get in there and do the same thing that like really good organizational kind of psychologists or good salespeople do, which is, again, just take that research and go, what are the tools that really work and how do they scale? So little things just like, hey, are they in our category would come up and you go, well, you know, one of the easiest way to convert people to a customer is to find out if they already participate in your category and they like it anyways. They need less support. They have less questions. They know they can get you to an answer much, much faster. So we built and patented an algorithm that would basically analyze their public text or email text or whatever, just to say, can we mathematically measure if they use our jargon? If they use the same slang I do about AI, if they're saying like RAG and, you know, GANs and other like technical jargon associated with my category, I can infer that they're actually probably an early adopter of my tech. And then I don't have as many headaches on explaining what I do. So one of the things we patented was an algorithm that would basically analyze your product, your category, take the jargon and the slang you use, and then compare it and measure whether or not your audience uses it using math. So you could actually start to figure out, hey, these people are like really expert. These people are actually not expert, but they're early adopt. They're probably willing to stand in line. Those people are pragmatic people. They don't want anything to do with it. How about we start over here? And it works. So that's some of what we do and how I got here was sitting behind one-way glass and starting to understand like, hey, there's actually much better ways with available data to make decisions about who you talk to and how do you talk to them that really scale and work much, much better. So when people hire us, that's what they're actually helping to do. How do I talk to this person? The answer is, you oftentimes in the best case scenario, you adapt depending on the audience. You really want to see who someone and salespeople who perform, they do that. They mirror their audience. You hear that in interviews and stuff, right? So I'm doing a job interview. They're like, sit with the same posture as your interviewee and stuff like that. It works. Married couples, stuff like that. You can actually predict the likelihood of someone's marriage sustaining based on how much they can mirror each other's personalities in many cases. And it's not necessarily even that complex, because ultimately, if you think about it, it removes psychological friction when you can take and you can mirror someone's demeanor, right? That you both know the rules of the road. And a really easy example is like extroverts. Everybody knows an extrovert. The extroverts like talking to other extroverts more than they like talking to introverts. And the same hold true for introverts.
It's tiring.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So take that. That premise to go, well, what if we start to adapt on how they think or how they make decisions or process information? You can very much actually get a lot of cues, like little tricks. You know, the only people who use 3 exclamation points in text threads are extroverts. So if someone does that, you go, okay, cool. They are more likely to prefer social proof as a method of actually making a decision. So it's not like you're manipulating them, but you can go, hey, if I go, hey, everybody's doing it, that actually is more likely to work with an extrovert. So you can take your sales materials, your messaging, and reposition it just so someone's more likely to accept the message, which means you get a decision faster, you get an informed decision faster, which means like oftentimes we go, yeah, we can increase revenue. And oftentimes that means you just get a no faster and you can move on to the next one. But I play in that field. We take and we analyze people's products. We turn that into a mathematical map and start to understand, okay, cool, how would you describe it to different audiences? Figure out who those audiences are and then help position them accordingly and then go from there. I love that stuff.
So, exclamation point, you just reminded me of a joke, a sitcom actually, when Elaine was on Seinfeld was having a relationship with her boyfriend, and then she ended up putting exclamation mark as she was editing his book. I'll put exclamation mark here. I'll put exclamation mark here on every single word. And then the boss comes in and say, get rid of the exclamation mark.
I've had almost that same argument with one of my co-founders. Turned out I was wrong too, actually.
Now, Dan, before, you know, things got really hyper-tech and got automated and algorithms and you're building all these things, just for the audience, was this process being done manually before to a painstaking effort, or was it not done at all and this technology enabled us to do it now?
I would argue, so humans can kind of do it, but they really suck badly at actually training other people to do it.
Probably not everybody can do it, right, Dan? Probably yeah, like there are selected few that can do it in their mind subconsciously pretty much.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's tons of people that are much better at reading just body signal. You know, about 85% of your communication is just body language.
Mm-hmm.
So like people can do it sometimes intuitively. Very few people can actually teach it. And even if you can teach it, doesn't necessarily mean someone can learn it. What's kind of happened that's made it more attractive. And again, people have been doing kind of segmentation with various different types of data for ever. There's more of it. There's more kind of digital exhaust around. There's more to work with. And that makes it easier to do. I would argue still a lot of people still actually suck quite badly at it. I mean, it's not easy. I would say I'm better than most, but I'm still not. I still say we have a long ways to go. But I think,
you know, I'm glad to hear you talk about the listening part, because I talk a lot about on this channel about the listening part. You know, when we're having a conversation specifically on the sales side, right? You mentioned it earlier, or any conversation for that matter, if two people are talking. And a lot of people, they want that moment at the podium, and everybody imagine themselves at the podium, and they never get, you know, to be frank and blunt, and they never shut up. And meaning that if we are to take the time to listen, to be inquisitive enough, and I had this boss one time, he says, he always framed it as be curious, you know, ask the question, right? So why, how do you feel about this? Or why is that happening? Yeah. And you know, I mean, last week I posted a podcast where I said, if you don't start by asking to the customer, for instance, things like what keeps you up at night? You know, what are the issues that in your mind as a business owner or a business leader keeps you up at night? How are you going to be able to solve this problem's nuisances or whatever they are, problems?
Yeah.
If you're just going to throw things on the wall, see what sticks, good luck with that.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree. A big part of some of the stuff I learned when I was kind of working in focus groups and kind of watching behind that one-way glass, there's a little trick people call the five whys. So if you're working on your product or you're talking to the prospective customer of your product, some of the best questions you can ask are just why five times in a row. Why does that matter? Why did you do that? Why? Well, why does that matter? What you fundamentally usually get to is, to your point, what keeps them up at night and why it keeps them up at night. And ultimately, one of the big tricks that you find out, everybody makes decisions based on emotion. They back it up with logic after the fact, right? But almost everything. If you can ask those questions to figure out what keeps them up at night, you can oftentimes actually, they forget what you say, but they won't forget how you made them feel. So they'll forget your data points, they'll forget this, that, and the other, but they will remember, like, during the moment that he had a good answer or they had a good answer that time, they were listening. So, I mean, it really can't be overstated. That listening and being able to adapt is huge, 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 huge.
You know, while I'm talking to you, I got a pop up on my screen. I posted a podcast with Henry DeVries. I call it DeVries, it depends on how you pronounce it. And he's an AP writer, an associate press writer, and he's also a ghostwriter for some of the big names that you know, the CEO of McDonald's, etc. Sure. And last week when I posted this podcast with him, he reminded me of one thing. He said, there was this person who came in to interview, well, to somebody. He was a young man, came to somebody, interviewed him as a hobby. And he interviewed him when he asked two questions that stuck to his mind, that this individual at this age can ask those informative questions. And then he told him in a letter, that's a follow-up letter, he told him, I would like to interview the CEO of this particular company. I can't get to him. He doesn't give me the airtime. It's very, way up there. I just can't get to him. But here's what I would like to ask him. Can you arrange that meeting for me? And because he asked the right questions, that meeting was arranged. That meeting took place, and this individual got the interview that he was asking for. So again, it's not about the information we're given. That's your point. It's how are we framing it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's, in this world, especially kind of with how technology is going, the importance of relationships, which in large part is that listening component, is getting more and more and more how people are making decisions. They're not leaving, like they're going into, I don't know about you. I don't go to Google. I haven't been to Google in a very long time. I have my own little kind of personal AI agents that act as personal assistants on my behalf, and they kind of act as a gatekeeper / whatever, right? Oftentimes the people that we're giving more preferential treatment to are the ones that we have those relationships with, and very specifically because they're a sounding board. They're not just a megaphone. I mean, if you go on a ton of people are like decreasing a lot of the time spent on social media and stuff because of that same fact, is it's all talking, not listening. It's not that interesting, it's hard. So I think the importance is only going up, and that should be a good thing. So.
You describe yourself, Dan, as someone who makes sure that the tech stack work for the team, not the other way around. Where did that philosophy get tested the hardest early in your career, do you think?
Oh tech stack. it's just, man, let's see. The reality is there are a ton of companies that people don't give enough credit to. Uber is an example. Uber is technological. They didn't invent much of anything that was like innovative per se. They made the technological friction and the friction of ordering a cab disappear. That is brilliant. That is, you don't even notice the app is the best possible experience, right? I've worked on apps, and I still am absolutely victim of this. When you're doing data science and stuff like that, I'm sure you've seen the same way. Like, I'll pull up charts and things like that and just go, holy crap, you have to stare at this thing for 5 minutes to figure out what it's actually saying. Oftentimes, really, we talk about it as seatbelts, but many of the companies, because we'll consult and be the underlying tech for a lot of other platforms too. So it's one of these lessons that I'm continually learning and continually finding out. ChatGPT's major innovation, LLMs existed 10, 20 years ago. Their innovation was the chat screen. They got an immediate interaction directly with an agent personalized to you with feedback. Before that, most of your AI, I don't know if you've played with it enough, you know that like maybe... what was that? Maybe like 8 years ago? Was it 8 years? How long have I been doing this one? The 8 years ago, you'd an AI project, you'd set it up and you'd wait 3 months to see the results, right? Machine learning based stuff back in the day because of the data preparation problems.
Yeah.
It was huge. Being able to melt that tech into the background has always been important. I think it's like paramount now. A bunch of what people are dealing with now is the drudgery that they used to get paid for is going away because you can make your own app. You can build your own CRM. I built our own CRM in 3 days a few weeks back just because I was like, I'm sick of putting up with HubSpot version. Let's just make one. So that's definitely came from a lot of those experiences, CRMs. But I learn it daily and continually refine it myself and still kick myself for being bad at it. So,
yeah, you know what? Technology is being democratized now, and everybody can get access to technology. And I hear quite a bit on this. I have the luxury to record 251 episode with this particular episode with you, Dan, here. So I've talked to a lot of experts. Back to your comment around AI existed for a long time. Indeed, it did. I've worked in the language industry. We've used forms of AI for the past 20 years, for that matter.
Right.
Statistical machine translation. MT in general. You know, I was part of the development group that worked on with the National Research Council on machine translation. We, you know, we tested it. We've worked with it initially when it came out 20 years ago. So, and I interviewed Dr. Sidney Shapiro on this podcast. He's he teaches postdoctoral candidates at the University of Lethbridge, Alberta, on this topic of AI. So he's, you know, he tells me like AI in general, it's databases and data vectoring and recognizing pattern within the data. So basically, you know, I, when I worked as a DBA for one of the largest insurance companies in North America, that's exactly what I was doing 30 years ago, you know, indexing, data vectoring, you know, imaging of data and recognizing pattern within the data. Technology today, the hardware part of the technology today allowed us to get recognize that pattern a lot quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. You're lucky too, to have the underlying understanding of what is going on behind the scenes. Like you use the word vector. Most people have no idea or how important that concept is. Just because like for those listening, if you're in on AI, the premise, which is governing self-driving cars and your LLM usage and everything else, it's the premise when I mentioned earlier that we figured out how to build a map using math. I was discussing vector embeddings, which basically were a big part of what requires that language to work. I mean, a big part of kind of your premise on localization. You can use the same word, but even the same word to two people who even grew up in the same area can have significant meanings. Like we used to get the example, I lived in China for a little while just to teach English. And I remember just talking to some of the people I worked around, and maybe it was just them, but their concept and their description, if you asked them for the definition of love in the context of who are you going to marry, you got a very different answer than I had ever heard before. It was closer to something, a little bit closer to an economic and socioeconomic relationship versus the US that I was used to. Simultaneously, you can even be in the US and grow up in the same household and go like, hey, their parents fight and their parents don't fight at all. The word love means you do fight a little bit. This other one, you can actually have these changes in language, and that vectoring allows basically data scientists to take a string of words and give them mathematical coordinates, an A, B, and a Z axis. So they're literally plotting them in a three-dimensional graph and then linking them up so they can go, okay, now I have the context because I know the words that they used, but I also actually know kind of the location and what context they occupied, which helps me understand the difference between, you know, the old example from IBM Watson back in the day was Paris Hilton. Are you talking about the hotel or the celebrity, right? It's like, okay, cool. This is how we can actually figure out that context. Man, it's one of those things like incredibly important technology and premise. And it's very much behind kind of who says what and how they say it or should say it.
And in which order they say these things, because, you know, we have the famous saying here in, well, example, I mean, it comes up in every once in a while, something similar comes up, you know, like coffee and bagel. You say that in French, I want coffee and bagel. But if you give it to a badly trained AI, it'll come back, I bageled my coffee. You know, it just, it's and this is in the order of which these words are put in a context, it makes a lot of difference in what you mean and how they mean these things. Now, Dan, if you don't mind, the word psychographic profiling sounds to a lot of people are listening to this, probably some of them, they know what that is. Most of them probably don't. Would you mind explaining what that is?
It's message preference. It's, you know, I mean, in the context in which we use it, you know, like what people, again, what they're saying in a fancy way is basically just how someone thinks. And oftentimes, as I've kind of mentioned on this one, the big deal is like, you know, I think people think that the tech is savvier than it is. And a lot of it is closer to luck. Again, a lot of what people like on LLMs and ChatGPT is that mirroring effect. It's able to use language that they already understood and things like that. And it reduces that psychological friction. And they like that. The psychological profiling is largely, again, can you help? And the biggest deal that I found, like, and I was surprised, it wasn't even that long ago, when you ask someone to develop like a segmented profile and decide and define their customer, even now, they'll still say, oh, they work for this company. They live in this area. And if you started to line up all of the different data that helped make a decision on whether or not someone became a customer, you can say demographics like age and stuff like that are at the bottom most of the time. Firmographics, if you're doing B2B, gets a little bit higher than that. So that's their company and how many employees and when their company was founded and industries and stuff like that. And as you get further up, the more behavior-based data becomes significant. So again, it's like when you're sitting on your internet browser, it doesn't matter if you're male or female or whatever. It's what you're typing into the browser and it's what you're searching for and it's what you're visiting. That behavior-based decision-making is a lot more informative of whether or not someone's in there. And most of the time, again, it depends on your product. Of course, there are exceptions. But again, it's like the internet brought us the phenomenon where the cost of switching products was nearly zero. And for that reason, one of the more important things you can do is customize or personalize the product back to that person. Since they can find anything and what they're typing into Google is a reflection of themselves. So that psychographics is basically going, hey, can we start to figure out how and why they think the way they do to help them, to help us understand again, how to talk to them. And so again, you can, you know, it sounds, you know, oftentimes people think of it as like scarier than it is, but in many cases, again, like exclamation points example is one of them. The nature of their conversations and stuff like that can help inform. You can use it, and the same logic comes in really handy for companies when they're like looking at customer support calls. You can start to use the same logic to say, well, how many did they have and how many mentioned feature one versus two? And then what was the sentiment on that feature? All right, let's go one step further. How many syllables were the words that they used when describing the problem?
Wow.
And you can start to go, wait a minute. So different subgroups actually use different technical jargon. So you can go, wait a minute, these guys over here were using this really technical high syllable count. You can actually start to find out that they bucket and they actually have the same concerns, the same interests, the same rank of feature interest. So you actually want a different message for them because feature two is their most important feature. But this other group over here, by the way, usually like late adopters is the other way to refer to them. The pragmatic decision makers, they care way more about discounts and just avoiding bugs. And oftentimes those really sophisticated category players, they actually really want to play with stuff that's pushing the limits and the boundaries of the category and feature sets. So it's analyzing and starting to use kind of, again, some of like kind of that digital exhaust and data, oftentimes in unstructured formats and things like that, which means like just data that's more of in a blob than in a spreadsheet and putting it into something that's a spreadsheet that makes it easier to analyze and understand and then turn into some useful insights. Again, what feature do we build next? Who do we talk to and what do we say?
So, you know, a lot of things in this statement that can be powerful, which I collect information, I get be more precise in my messaging, etc. But the flip side of that, I don't know if you've dealt with this before, Dan, and like your input on it, and at least give me your comments on the technical part, how do you pull it together, and the ethical part as well. There's a lot of things that can go wrong in here. And at the same time, you know, from a guardrails perspective, you know, what would that look like for Wrench.ai?
Sure. So let's take those kind of in part. So technical stuff, again, like, I mean, oftentimes what you're doing, and people don't know this, but oftentimes, especially now, I can give you, here's an example. Last time you had to deal with a cell phone bill. You had to call that company and then they probably transferred you two or three times. And by the third
time— Don't get me going. Yesterday, I was so frustrated with the cell phone company.
So what you find from that phenomenon, and this has actually gone up pretty substantially, especially since COVID, is that people know the data is out there and they actually punish you for not using it if your context is appropriate. Your cell phone company has your billing records, has your credit card on file. They know which one you bought. They know all of the things they ask you to tell them every time you call. And I haven't met a single person who was happy with it. Why do I have to tell you my phone number? I called you. You like all of these things. What you learn from that experience is that if you have that information and you're already engaged in a relationship with that customer, they actually penalize you for not using it. They want you to use it. It is out there. Simultaneously, you had a lot of stuff like Cambridge Analytica and things like that from 7-8 years ago and things like that, where people will go through and the big thing with Cambridge Analytica was not that they were segmenting. They were actually stealing the data to do it. Facebook got in a lot of trouble for doing it. They handed them data they shouldn't have had in the first place. I mean, that was very much kind of the lesson from that, was actually the proprietary of the data. You focus a lot on one, B2B relationships. I mean, there's several things that you do to make this easier. And we found out actually like very early, because again, there are a ton of people, don't surprise people in a good way. If you even found out, again, from totally publicly available data, like if you're doing, say, a B2B, your salesperson is going to go look up your LinkedIn profile. They're going to use that same data. It's not behind a firewall or anything else, right? Use that data information. If you go beyond that, you actually hurt conversions in many ways. If you go, oh yeah, like go ahead, if you really do it, and you can go do it, go look up someone, like even that, you know, just use Google. You don't have to use anything weird, but ask them a question that you could have found out, but you shouldn't have known if you were just doing a glance, like, hey, I know that you happen to love rubber ducks. You should be like, what the hell? Where did that come from? They don't want to know that, and you don't want to introduce it into the relationship. And so again, a big part of what you do to avoid running afoul is make sure that you have data that's clean. And oftentimes the best place to start is from people that already have existing databases and relationships. That if you already have an email and a customer service chain, you can just improve that and reinforce the relationship. Oftentimes if you're doing it, focus on publicly available data that you don't have to look hard for, and you don't go so deep. I can tell you, oftentimes when you do go deep, you find out stuff that, one, you didn't want to know, and then you find out what you didn't want to know in the first place. Oftentimes the people that sold you that data sold you crap data. There's a lot of garbage out there. And the stuff that you do want to use, again, as appropriate, it should be appropriate to the level of the relationship. I want a high level abstract view if we're establishing a relationship, but I don't want you to go. And if I have interacted with you, use the data that you're already collecting, just make better use of it. They reward you for that handsomely. And so a lot of the ethics questions come with those kind of same kind of decisions, but it works better. It makes things less complex. Salespeople introducing something that's just way too deep damages and just derails the relationship anyways. It's one of the reasons we actually anonymized a lot of it. So you talk about vector embeddings. One of the things that we used in one of our patents was taking some of that jargon. So like I could take a bunch of that publicly available data that is out there and imagine like spreadsheets on spreadsheets on spreadsheets on spreadsheets. But what if I could just distill it all down using vectors in one example to just a localization fireside chat score, where it's just like, hey, I can actually distill the fact that they're talking about podcasts, they're talking about localization and other related terms. And I can give you a scale of 1 to 100. And the higher the number is, the more they're just talking about stuff like your podcast and company. And so the higher it is, the sooner when you get on the call, they already are in the tent, so to speak. You don't have to explain what a podcast is. That score actually removes a ton of the problematic data that's underlying it. That's like, oh, they posted this thing about one podcast that they don't listen to anymore, or something like that. It actually sanitizes, because the client and the team using it, it's way more valuable for them, and it's almost worthless to anybody else, right? Like, okay, so if someone stole your data set that included, you know, everybody that's a listener of LFC and then hacked it, what would they do with it? Nothing. What are you going to do with it? A lot. Because, you know, okay, I'm going
to. Right. It's important to you, not to anybody else.
Yeah. The really high scoring ones are probably sponsor opportunities and stuff like that, right? It's like the other ones, I need to make it easier to kind of wade them into the deep end. So there's a few kind of examples on how you avoid it.
Now, in terms of what you're describing, it sounds like your customers, the users of Wrench.ai, need to understand who is their ideal customer profile before they engage and they get into it. In order for them to determine what signals they need to listen to, et cetera. Do you find that there is a disconnect or between what people actually looking for and versus what they are actually seeing out there?
Yeah. Very few people actually know. When they come in, they oftentimes describe who they think they are. You know, you've heard of like personas and segmentation like that. And they go, okay, cool. We've got listener Larry, and listener Larry is a airline pilot from Cincinnati. And you go, cool. Is an airline pilot, is that the average, are they all airline pilots, or is that the average job? And how do you average out to an airline pilot? Does that mean most of them are in the air? A lot of that stuff doesn't actually stand up to scrutiny. So people will oftentimes come in and go, hey, yeah, we do know our customer. And you go, kind of. And it's one of the reasons that oftentimes using those behavioral signals, like if I talk about this, I want to know how many podcasts they listen to and how often yours is amongst that. What's your share of listening, or, you know, what's your share of headphones, you know, making that
metric up.
I'm sure it exists in some other format. Those actually become much more useful metrics to do so. And that's oftentimes what we're doing, is helping them identify, hey, these are the things that they actually care about on your product. Here are the other things. You really do find out the stuff. Like when you go into machine learning models, you take that spreadsheet and it'll have maybe 10,000 columns, right? Everything, like, you know, if they're listening to podcasts, it's how many seconds, how many podcasts, how many episodes, all that stuff can be in there. Massive data set. When you put that into a machine learning model, it says which ones are actually our customers. And then you kind of, you reverse engineer, if you will, but, you can basically reverse engineer to get the features that made that prediction and how accurate they are. So you can kind of, it's kind of like getting, tasting a cake and then reverse engineering the recipe. I can taste this much sugar, this much flour. Then you can start to build a recipe of, hey, here's all the stuff that actually made the cake taste like that, right? So these machine learning models, they're actually doing that. And oftentimes what you find out is the recipe is nowhere near what people thought it was. And that's very, very common, is that we surprise them. And usually that's how we surprise them, is, hey, this data point that you guys weren't thinking. I've had one client, one of the things that really drove the needle for them was targeting prospects whose employer focused on happiness as a major part of their cultural goals for their employees. Just one of those things where, where the hell did that come from? But cultural fit between them and their partner companies was really, really high, because they both had that kind of focus on lifestyle and happiness as well. And they jived really well. So we went, hey, that data set, we can actually go figure out who those companies are really easily. And that's your entry point. Go in, start talking about the livelihood and the happiness of employees. That is your intro. Really cool stuff like that comes up. So it's always surprising. And again, there is a ton of data out there, but there's a ton of garbage that you have to pour through as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oftentimes, again, finding those insights are going, really, where did that come from? Or, hey, by the way, this month, this theme showed up in conversations that hasn't shown up before. Let's build something to kind of approach and attack and mitigate it. So,
you know, you just reminded me, I just interviewed Wynn Schwarta on the call earlier today. And we're talking about cognitive cybersecurity. And, you know, his advice to everybody says, you know, you talk about data noise, you know, you know, don't trust anything verified twice.
Trust. All others bring data.
You talk about neuroscience of trust in digital experiences as a core part of advisory work. Can you unpack that for us? And when you say trust, are you talking about cognitive trust, emotional trust, or something else entirely different in this case?
It comes up in multiple ways, just because like you've heard of Maslow's hierarchy. If you started and you take Maslow's hierarchy into higher levels, so like you people always think about like air, water, food, shelter. You can keep going and you actually start to see metaphysical, emotional, and other type of states like, all right, cool. Is trust a fact? You are not going to build a relationship with someone who doesn't trust you. For us being in data, one of the things that really absolutely poisons a well is people, they trust us with their data. They also trust us to basically report back to them objectively. And one of the things that you oftentimes find out, at least in our very significant choice of business, everybody assumes that data has mathematical perfection and there's black and white and there is no gray area, when in reality, almost everything is grayer and there's very little black and white. But when you're building...
Yeah, we don't live in a binary world, is that what you mean?
Everyone would love to as well. And everybody's assumption is, oh, well, if they have the data must be accurate. It's like,
no. Yeah, no.
You're trying to find the nice house on a bad block, right? Like you're going, all right.
What's the needle in the haystack again.
And so for us, it comes up in multiple ways. Like, again, like we talked about earlier, when I say trust and stuff, working with the salesperson, like, why would you introduce something that would potentially damage the relationship like that? Go, hey, give them enough that it actually streamlines their conversation. If I can take an hour of research and turn it into 30 or 40 seconds, you're still showing up, you're just doing, and you're able to make more informed calls, and you don't know anything you shouldn't know and anything that could damage you. This is the smart way. And oftentimes that kind of reciprocal relationship goes that way. Simultaneously, from a vendor perspective, I've had it, and There is nothing worse from a data science perspective than sitting in a call or a deliverable with a client and finding out that there was something wrong with your underlying data, because it oftentimes means like everything up until that point now comes into question. So like they'll just be like, well, if that's wrong, what else is wrong? And they'll assume it's all wrong. So it happens to be a hazard of my specific business that you have to go and pour over that data, not once, not twice, not three, but 50 times to make sure you can say, okay, cool. Here's what we really know. And here's what we do not know. And I think it goes both ways. I wanted to, you know, like I want to die with smile wrinkles on my face. And so a big part of that is like, okay, what are we building and how do we use it? And one of the biggest first things that we wanted to use it for was to help people find, especially in go-to-market situations, who to talk to. That's such a hard pivotal moment in a company's life. And it's so pivotal to other people. I was going, if I can help 100 people find their muse, establish a company, pay a mortgage and pay employees, I will happily die with smile wrinkles on my face, regardless of what my bank account looks like. And so a big part of it was actually helping people kind of establish their goal in life. And that's a big part of it. That kind of, yeah, I don't want to look over my shoulder. And a big part of that is, let's just keep that as a big part of kind of how we operate.
So Wrench AI reduces acquisition cost by 83%, and that's what I've gathered through my research, which is a number that people would think, can I trust that number? It sounds too big. You know, how valid is it? And what's actually being removed from the equation of the customer acquisition here? Is it wasted spend, wasted time, or wasted human effort, or all three?
Yeah, so that's a really good one, because it actually, I mean, you have to, when you measure these things, you have to actually pull a different way, because you can say, like that metric specifically, that's actually one from a case study from years ago. The combination, I think if I remember the exact case output, was around, we figured out we were about 35 times more accurate than a human in identifying investors, accredited investors, high net worth individuals that were investing into new startups. We were about 35. So like their existing process was having a human go through their Rolodex of thousands of existing known relationships with their investor network group, and then finding a new startup and then connecting the two. And that person's job was to sit down at a Rolodex all day and go, okay, cool. I've got this founder and I think this investor is a match. You found out, and I think the top line was something like we were 30 times more accurate, and I want to say 35 times faster. And you have to kind of come back and basically go, okay, cool. What are the acquisition costs? And ultimately you have to combine, and this is what a lot of people need to be doing right now, if they're dealing with implementing AI adoption at their corporation and organization, there's a lot of headlines floating around right now around there is no ROI on AI. Go look behind the headline on that, because it's this same fundamental problem. It isn't that there wasn't an impact. It's that the impact was hard to measure, so people didn't measure it. That happens overwhelmingly most of the time. Yeah, we put it in there, but we didn't track what our benchmark was.
What's the output? What's the outcome?
So they say there's no ROI. It's like, well, was there an impact? Oh yeah, we're getting 10 times as much done. It's like, well, but yes, then there is. So heads up, anytime anybody says that stuff, just take a moment and go say, what study did you pull that from? And I will bet you money, when they go pull it, they will find out that people weren't measuring in the first place. And it's not that there isn't an impact. It's that they didn't measure it properly. And therefore they just say there is none, which isn't the same thing. When you get into those, it's often because of the difficulty in those, they will say, okay, cool. Well, we saved time and we got accuracy. How do we put those together into an average quote unquote number? And that is some of the stuff you have to get to. Some of the stuff that we work on heavily now, but like when people do ROI AI adoption, they're implementing AI agents in their systems and they're trying to measure how much better do they get. We use some of our tech and have built dashboards to help people do that. And oftentimes what they don't measure is the negative sentiments. So again, like when you go through, you have to lay out and you have to establish that benchmark of what were you doing in the first place. And it is very much like setting it up as a science experiment. You go through, you build kind of the hypothesis. I think it'll go this way. But you establish your parameters up front. And again, everybody forgets to establish a benchmark in the first place. And therefore they go, okay, now we know what it is. Like, well, what was it before? I don't know. And now it's been 3 months and we can't recreate. It's like, damn it.
Because you're starting from a blank sheet of paper, like somebody coming in and saying, well, how much do we spend on translation? Well, did you track it before? No. Well, yeah. How are you going to be able to figure it out? Like, you got to start now, and I'll tell you again in 12 months from now. So.
Very much so. Like part of our onboarding process is we require that they benchmark what their current process is and looks like because of that exact reason. You find out you can have like case studies on almost all of your companies when you do that, just because you go, hey, we actually did track what it was and now we know what it is and it's not too late. Oftentimes you do need really savvy people. And that's one of the reasons that when people are dealing with a lot of new tech questions, I like the best data scientists I've ever had. You've met a bunch. The best ones tell you not to use AI once in a while, at least, you know, like, I mean, now it's all over. It's nauseating almost how often you hear the damn term AI. And you
know, oh my God, it's just becoming so monotonous now.
Yeah. So we've measured our own. We've measured our own and we have taken AI out of our marketing materials twice now because we found out multiple times in history, right before ChatGPT, it was just like smoke and mirrors. People didn't know it was a thing and just went, yeah, take it out and don't even talk. I'm in the same point now where I go, we're data-driven decisioning because I want to make sure that we're actually accomplishing and hitting those KPIs. And it comes from being able to measure a few different ways and having smart people that can actually compare the A versus the B and put it together. So,
now, Dan, the audience listening to this, some of them or most of them are in the localization industry. That's the language industry. They are translating and adapting contents to dozen languages in dozen markets, many markets around the world, or even locally for that matter. I mean, I live in Toronto. I mean, Toronto, we got like, I don't know, the last RFP request for proposal for language support that the city put out, I think had like 100 languages in it or something. I mean, we all live in, you know, cosmopolitan, whatever you want to call them, areas. So most of the things like language personalization variable is, you know, variable, but they really they don't have any behavioral data around it to prove that conversation internally in their corporation. So let's say I'm a manager of a language department working for a bank. I go to my manager, say, you know, we need to translate so our customers can, you know, work with us better or improve our relationship with our customers, but they don't have any quantifiable data for that. They just have their emotional, you know, sensory data that go into, we need to translate to French because if we don't translate to French, our customer's not going to buy from us. Well, the manager's going to ask, well, do you have any quantifiable data for this? They don't have any. Does this, what you're talking about today, does it help?
Yeah. I mean, we talked about the kind of the friction from Uber, that psychological friction from using the right word in the right context absolutely speeds up. I mean, you can go talk to, you know, we've done studies when we were, you know, building some of those same benchmark studies where we were going, hey, we helped these clients. Like, so we have and have worked with clients whose job it is to launch new products on behalf of other companies, sales organizations and stuff like that. They have the headcount, you bring in the product, they train them on your product. And we're going, hey, we figured out that if you actually streamline and do exactly what you're talking about. And again, to your point earlier, you've actually worked on that same problem too. Just because you did a direct translation from one word to another does not mean that you actually translated it correctly, right?
No, you're not.
Nauseating. And you find out a ton of there, you know, I went to school at an international business school called Thunderbird. We had like 30, 40 different nationalities represented. It was like the reason that you go to that school. And they, you know, you find out we had to take classes called cultural orientation indicators. And you found out that like, even though, you know, different cultures will like, I remember one part of it was talking about between the US and Mexico, they had defined there were fluid and pointillist, I think was their word, parameters on time. So they're like, just heads up. If you say 2 p.m. in the US, it means 2 p.m. And if you go to Mexico, it means the afternoon sometime. And little nuances like that made the translation just, you can use the right word, you can dramatically change the meaning. We worked on a Department of State contract once where they were talking about the challenges on sentiment and translation, just because, again, oftentimes like a lot of these tools and even still can't capture sarcasm. I went and I remember we built a model for one client that was having us interpret their product reviews. And they wanted us to build a feature map to basically tell us, I'll take all the features and then I want you to map which ones were the most to the least important so we can rank them and optimize our messaging. And when we went and did that analysis, the semantic came back as, oh, well, from those features, you had 10% positive and you had 10% negative and you had 80% mixed. And it's like, oh, what do I do with that? I don't know. a lot of the data out there is still like that. I mean, it's one of the reasons, I mean, because they're getting better at it, but localized translation is a very difficult thing to actually get right because of those same mistakes, right? I mean, you know this way better than I do. So I'm going to shut my big mouth on it.
But No. It's all relatable because, you know, when I'm talking to, like, let's say market research firms, you know, your Ipsos Reid, Nielsen, and those guys, right? So, and they're doing surveys, let's say, on specific product or specific topic, and that survey goes around, I don't know, say 100 countries. And you cannot use the same survey. It was like developed, let's say, somewhere in the US, and you want to deploy it in 100 countries. You got to read every one of those surveys and position those questions accurately for each one of those countries. Anything from something as, you know, as logical as what is the salary band, for instance. Salary bands in the US are completely different from salary bands in other countries.
Yeah.
So you got to make sure that you're available to think that way, and you cannot broadcast one message across 100 countries.
And you've probably had this exact experience. So I'd mentioned too, where if we have the wrong data in some way, shape, or form, they'll question the entire thing. Take one of those surveys, because I guaranteed some of these consumer insights people have had this situation where they go in, they sit down with the executive, they're reading the results, and they're like, question 14, it says that you're talking about the manual. Do you mean the manual or the manual operation of the stick shift in the car? And they go pale and blood leaves their face. And they realize some, because especially with those, you can't go back. It's not like you can just ask the question again, right? And they just realize that they missed something that was just so nuanced and small, but completely means, all right, throw that not even question, potentially the entire section out, because you just changed the entire meaning of that entire research study. So really important. And you find out certain cultures like that. I remember case studies for introducing Windows to Germany versus other countries where they demanded a thick engineering manual. They put a lot of emphasis on the value of the product would be influenced by the size of the manual. They prefer the engineering approach there. They want a technical manual with jargon. And then other cultures are like, no, I'm never even going to touch the manual. Don't even give me a manual. It scares me.
Right.
So it's not even just the language they use, it's the nature in which they introduce that product.
And it has 100%. A massive effect. Right? I interviewed a renowned linguist from Pakistan on the channel a few months ago. And I was informed during that conversation that 120 million people uses their mobiles in that country in English. I said, why not translate it to local language? Because they could not agree on the term. It is translated, but the people, they revert back to English because the translation is so messed up. They prefer to read it in English than actually use it in their local language. Something about the terminology used, it is not conducive to how they use it locally on the ground in that region.
I mean, it really is. You are reading probably most explicitly on that psychological. If you could just say it the way in which I understood it, this would be easy, right? It's one of those. And think about how common and how significant that problem actually is for every company, every business, every person, every day. It's a massive, massive unlock to solve. So.
No, you literally describe your ideal customer as a CRO trying to fix a leaky pipeline. That's what I spent most of my 30 years trying to do. And it's hard. You know why it's hard? It's not necessarily, the work that you've, it is the data or the people. It's mostly people trusting or seeing the signals early enough before the customer leaves. I feel like, if the radar can cover 10 miles, you need a radar that covers 100 miles to see the events are going to happen and prevent them from happening in terms of customer leave us. How do you put this together from a trust perspective to an individual who's going to be reading the data and say, listen, in 6 months from now or whatever, I'm just using 6 months arbitrarily here, but in a period of time, based on this trajectory of this behavior, this particular customer is going to leave you.
Yeah. So there's a few different ways you do it, and it's an interesting problem because I find out that people really want a ton of what we do, but they will ask the question, how do you do it? They don't want the answer. They want to know they can get the answer if they ever need it.
Nobody wants to put the effort there, Dan.
And what they're looking for, because this is another thing that really makes kind of like the nonverbal and those other cues really significant, because you behind the one-way glass, I found plenty of times where I'd go, they asked this question, but they're actually asking another one, right? Again, the why behind this question is very different and significant. And so I can tell you that like one of the ways that the typical group in data science will do it is they'll do a double blind type of report, blah, 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 blah. And then as soon as they hand it to the client, it'll get thrown in a drawer and no one will look at it until something goes sideways. And then they will open the drawer and they will go back. And we talk about it like we describe seatbelts. No one is going to buy your car because it has seatbelts. But no one will buy your car if it doesn't have seatbelts, right? It is one of these things that we go, that data needs to largely be there, but it needs to be in the background and they need to know that they can get it when they need to. And for that reason, I oftentimes go, okay, cool. We need to, and we do, spend a lot of time like building the reports and we build them to a sophisticated level. So I go, you know, you may be the CRO, but you can hand this report to your data science or someone that you trust on that one and they will not be able to poke holes in it. So we take that approach where I go, you need to have a section where that's available, but then move it into the fourth tab so that they can audit it. They can see that it's evolving. These things matter. And that they can come back to it if something goes sideways. Something is inevitably going to go sideways or need an explanation. And we need to basically make sure that we've already managed expectations, that it will happen. We know what to do. And we've been transparent on how we've made decisions so we don't have to. One of the other things you actually, so what you just described though is actually a dirty little trick that a lot of data scientists will pull. So heads up to listeners. They'll build, for the CRO, they'll build lead scores that evolve and update daily so that like they have these really, we're really good at predicting customers. The really, really, really good lead scoring segmentation stuff. So I'm going to give everybody a 1 to 100 on whether or not they're likely my customer. If they introduce a bunch of data during the relationship, they're biasing the crap out of that model. Think about it. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, they landed on this page. Oh, they opened this email. It's like, okay, so the more they interact with us, the more they're likely to convert. Okay, cool. But that just means all of the ones that get to the end of the funnel just have better and higher numbers at the end. It looks like it's right. You want the people that can take your data and say, I can predict your customers at the top of the funnel, and I'm going to leave that score out there for you. And then we're going to re-audit this in 3 months. And I'm going to reference the original, hey, they just showed up on the doorstep. This one's a 90. I'm going to show you those numbers at the end of the 3 months without changing that number. Before we knew if they were going to open our emails, those are the really, really interesting ones. And then I would say the other thing too is if you can build a culture in your company that they see as well, ours and one of the, we said, look, if you've got another team, another vendor, or another method that's better than ours, I'll send you my resume. Where I want to, ego is the enemy. I don't care if I'm right. I just want to be on the team that's right. I'm happy with that. And not having the ego and just going, look, we mentioned earlier, in God we trust, all others bring data. Make sure that you have a culture, not just with your own internal team, but with your client, that if they have some other additional evidence, I will change my mind like that and it will not hurt my feelings. That's a strength, not a weakness. Right. I still don't think that many people actually believe that. And I don't know why. It's like, you flip-flopped. You're lucky. Good. Introduced to new and better evidence. And I changed my mind immediately. I don't want not to.
We need more people like you, Dan.
No, but yes. Thank you. there's the technical answer, but then there's the kind of the cultural and the other one.
No, you know, I mean, I've been building this podcast for the past 3 years. This is episode 251. I've spoken to many people on the channel. If you were to run wrench.ai on my podcast, you know, what am I, expected to find as a result of that?
So, I mean, what I can do is, and you know, oftentimes what I, you know.
What would the report look like, I guess, for me? What would I, do I gain information that I did not have before? I'm sure I would, but what type of information?
Like, so what people usually do in podcast situations is a dossier. It's a pre-screening. So how long did it take you to do the research for this?
It took me 30 minutes, maybe.
All right, cool. What if I could make it take 30 seconds?
Yeah.
So what I can do is I can take the profile and imagine something that looks relatively close to like a baseball card. Got the person's photo. You have kind of job title, some of that other stuff that you need for kind of background sake. We have a little bit of stuff that's around them exclusively, with archetypes, but you're talking basically about kind of like personality type stuff. This is generally their demeanor. This is the type of way that they process decisions. So like, hey, this is a person that cares about relationships and is focused mostly on family and blah, 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 that type of thing. You'll get a blurb on that. Below that, you'll start to get information on interaction between you and them. So I have my own profile. My profile is Dan is data-driven, managerial type of blah, 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 blah. It's how he thinks, that type of stuff. Processing and getting that information actually says, okay, cool, here's where you two overlap. And those are oftentimes hot points or icebreakers or easy things to talk about. Hey, if hey, we both love language and both love kind of, this is a subject matter that lights us both up and it's an easy place to start and kind of establish that trust, right? So there, and then at the bottom, usually towards the bottom is where we start to introduce stuff where I can take, so I could take the subject matter that you talk about, everything from say podcasts, different episodes, different subject matter. And then I can give you those rank scores for them. So we can say, hey, you talk about international politics and you talk about products and you talk about tech. For you and Dan specifically, tech is a 90. You both know the most about that. Therefore, when you get onto this call, here's Dan's demeanor. He's managerial. He's data driven, blah, 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 blah. And also, by the way, you should lean the most on tech because it's what you and him both mutually know the most about. And it'll be the easiest and the least friction in that conversation. That, and then at the top and stuff, we have like lead scoring and other thing as well. That's what the snapshot looks like. The underlying data can be thousands and thousands and thousands of rows. The AI agents that we work with, they read that data. They're already trained on how to interpret it. And that data is like right near the surface. So if you ask the question, like, give me five questions that should be related to Dan, it pops up with them. Looks just like ChatGPT, but the data driving the output is way more informed and way more likely to be right, less hallucinations type stuff.
I'm wondering what's your opinion, because I've used Humantic.ai before when I was like managing sales teams. I left that job about in November last year, and I asked my sales teams to use it, which gives me that, what you just mentioned, Dan, a bit of a radar, I guess, before we get into a conversation with somebody. I'm assuming yours is a little bit more detailed than that. You're getting into the meat of things.
Sure. The viable comparison, we've tried to focus more, and again, our shtick is a lot more around, again, category type of participation. And again, the more that we've worked on it, the more we've moved that technology just behind the scenes. It doesn't mean that it's not working. It means that, again, it's the seatbelt. I can pull it up if I need to, if I want more backup and stuff like that. But for the most part, my best experience is I want to go, hey, can you create and help me draft this podcast interview and make sure that it's data driven? Boom, done. Here's five things. Here's why, type of thing.
You know, that would be very helpful for me right now because I've automated everything in the podcast right now. I've written my own, what I call application to manage the entire podcast. Yeah. I call it Podflow. Yeah. Yep. And it takes it from prepping to production, basically, and posting and doing all the other stuff. And one thing is, I guess it's missing out of the research is that personality traits. I get all the other information out there. I was doing one time a podcast with somebody and I said, you lost your father at the age of 10. You know, how did that make you feel? He said, how did you get that information? I didn't really. I mean, Grok did it. I just copied it, to be honest with you. So it is, you know, it's very in depth from the research perspective, but lining up the personality is very interesting.
It's very fun stuff. It works well. And one thing I can tell you too, because the Grok thing, so LLMs are really, really good at summarizing information, right? They're basically collapsing down vectors. And so they can
correct, do stuff
like that. It's really handy. What people don't oftentimes know about them is when you have them build strat, like if you have them go play chess, even now, they start making illegal moves almost immediately, meaning they can't simultaneously keep in memory two steps ahead. And for that reason, a lot of those, it looks, you know, For people that don't know, LLMs couldn't be described simpler. They're autocomplete on steroids. They fill out a sentence using the most popular answer, not the smartest answer. So if you have them referencing an underlying data set the way we do, they're more likely to actually respond accurately. But oftentimes people use those for lead scoring and for building playbooks. The more you do that, if you map out like what their answers were and you actually plot them, put them into kind of a feedback loop system, it looks a hell of a lot like guessing. It looks like really well-crafted guessing, but it sure as shit looks like guessing.
You know, I'm going to make you laugh. I'm going to make the audience laugh. Somebody compared it on this podcast here, AI, to a drunk uncle at a wedding. You hear a little bit of a wisdom, but there's a lot of BS going on.
That's a great description. That's it. It sounds great. The prose is magnifique, but oftentimes the logic behind it leaves you wanting, especially when the more we analyze it, you know, put 10,000 decisions from ours versus theirs versus whatever, whoever's, the more you go, okay, cool. It looks good, but check it again. I think that's where a lot of technology is headed in the very near future is, again, mixed models, whatever you want to talk about it, world models. People are going, okay, we need to take, like, those generative things are nifty, but by themselves, they are very problematic. You got to mix them with other stuff.
Dan, what do you think 2 years from now, what's the one thing about how companies do outreach today will look like outdated today in the future? You know, as the facts, you know, remember the facts? I can't believe it. I still have a fax number. And it looks, you know, for us right now, we look at the facts as, oh my God, I was just talking to Wynn Schwartau earlier and I mentioned the telex for some reason. It just came back to me because when I was a kid, I worked at as a teller at a bank during my high school, and we used to receive telex confirmation for trades. And we had this big telex machine in the office. It's a dinosaur boat anchor, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
What would you think 5 years from now? What would that outreach look like? Because things are advancing at a rapid stage now.
They are very, 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 very fast. Tiringly so. It's interesting that you bring up the fax machine because the fax machine was, how do I say it right? The network effects associated with the fax machine were the thing that made it valuable in the first place. It wasn't, if you're the only one with one, boat anchor. If everybody has a fax machine, fantastic communication.
Beautiful, device, yeah.
Can't live without, yeah. Right?
And it all advanced from the Morse code there, Ben.
Right? The phenomenon that I think we're currently in is the cost of incremental content is nearing or at zero. We create more content. Was it 2 years ago? We were creating as much data like every 2 weeks as we had in the entire compendium of the world. And if that trend has continued, which I presume it has, it's absolutely just mind-blowing that we're creating that much. So if the cost to create incremental content is zero, the quality of that content actually has to go up. And I think that you mentioned so many people are actually dealing with the awareness problem, right? They're at the top of the funnel and they're trying to figure it out. I think the reaction to that is relationships in a good way. It will be, well, what I need to do is what I should have been doing all the time. I need to go to talk to the people that I already know. I need to make sure that we already have a good relationship. And I need to know if they can help me find or introduce me to someone else that they know that because of our standing strong relationship, they're willing to actually just endorse me. I think the relationship-based brand is one of the best investments that you can currently make. And I think mining your current Rolodex for those existing relationships, understanding insights and introductions is the best place you can go first to find more, because I think the value of it just gets more nauseating every day between spammy emails and stuff like that. It doesn't work. They're blocking them. They're not even looking. I have a personal email that I grew up with that I check maybe monthly now. I just don't even go there. As people are evolving to, let's call it a zero interface internet architecture, most of what most people see now is just that chat screen. And beautiful, because I only want to see information about what I'm asking for right now. We're going to get closer to that, which means people are going to have to find sneakier, better, and more relevant ways to get introduced to me. They're going to lose interest in the spammy, you know, shotgun blast everything everywhere. And I think that's about time. So the quality of the content will go up. The quality of the relationships will probably be the thing that drives it, and those introductions. So I'm leaning in that direction. I think that's a smart place.
If you're interested, and I 100% agree with your assessment, by the way, but if you are interested, I'll introduce you to the president of the Global Chamber of Commerce, where I just joined them about a month ago, and I'm seeing a lot of that introduction that you mentioned earlier. A very, very interesting way to go about things, because you're right. Your inbox got to be thing of the past. Unless you have some sort of a filters on steroid where it only gives you the absolute message that you absolutely, your eyes have to read it. The rest is going to be garbage.
Yep. Wholeheartedly agree. So I'm, at least in that sense, I'm kind of excited for that world. I don't want billboards everywhere. We don't need any more billboards.
And there's a lot of bots out there, right? So, I mean, I interviewed people who are in the recruiting business. Here's an example, right? So you've got somebody who's looking for a job using a bot to build his CV, promote himself, etc. The recruiter on the other side using bots to filter all this. And the two of them are sitting at Starbucks having coffee. They don't know each other. And they're probably sitting at this, opposite sides of the two different tables, working on two separate laptops, building the same thing.
Right. Oh, man. I know every once in a while I catch myself, I'm at my house and I'll be like sitting with my wife and realize we're both looking at our phones. It's like, what are we doing? What are we doing?
Crazy. So. If you had to leave the audience and the localization professionals or the language technology leaders today, or global business leaders or global business builders, in one thing they can do Monday morning using what we talked about today, what would that be?
Right now, because at least in, again, I'm in tech, I'm in data science, so I have to deal a lot with the world and how it's changing in terms of interacting with devices and stuff like that. And like you described, you know, I've got an agent, they've got an agent type of thing. Really focusing on the things that you pay money for, the things that you're really good at, and the things people will pay you to do, and helping to focus on, I think our world's going to change pretty significantly in the next 5 years. And the way a lot of this technology and stuff is going, a lot of it's generally about at an average human decisioning level right now. So whether or not you believe in like super intelligence and stuff like that, in my opinion, the people that are going to be staying in their professions the longest are going to be the ones that genuinely appreciate the drudgery and love it. So I go find the things that you actually really, really care about that you're currently doing. And when you get up on Monday morning and you start building those agents, you start building loops, right? You start building the tools to work the drudgery out of that work so that you're thinking on a strategic level about how you do that job efficiently. That's the stuff that a lot of the people that I'm watching right now don't realize how big that train is that's coming their way. And I very much worry on whether or not, like, it's like, hey, you need to make sure that you're relevant, and to do that you need to in that vertical. So be focusing on how and why you make the decisions you do. Don't be focusing on, you know, how you do the ticky-tack, you know, writing the email and stuff like
that. I've done a podcast on this particular topic. It's called The Defensible Zone. Basically, what are your core competencies that nobody can take away from you? Not necessarily, oh, I'm good at entering data in Salesforce. That's sure. Everybody's, you know, that's gone. What is your core competency? Do a self-reflection, go below the surface and go to the core of who you are as an individual and try to figure out what makes me in terms of, I've got a good critical thinking. I've got a good way of assessing things and seeing things beyond the obvious. Those are going to be critical value in the future.
Critical thinking skills, fallacies, and recognition on decisioning, I think is just massively important now more than ever. So,
Dan, where can people find you and learn more about wrench.ai? Obviously, the website is one, but if they want to connect with you personally on LinkedIn, is that it? Or
yeah, hit me up. I'm on LinkedIn, I will.
And I know you have a podcast of your own too. What's the name of your podcast?
Burn the Map.
Burn the Map.
You know, everybody thinks it's like, no, don't reference the map. I'm like, no, it's when you actually exhaust all knowledge and internalize the knowledge from the map and you burn the map to use it for other purposes. But burn the map is, we actually do that. I've always been fascinated with the little misfit players that work on and build stuff despite the odds.
That's right. So
we talk to a lot of people that are oftentimes in the midst of the craziest, okay, how did we pull that? I like talking to those people and just going, why are you doing what you're doing? And watch them light up. It is so cool. And you meet the most interesting people. So my team said, hey, you need to do a podcast. I said, I'll do it on one condition. I want to talk to like the crazy ones. I want to talk to people doing some stuff where the odds are not in their favor on some really cool subject matter. So yeah, hit it up and listen to us there. Dan@WrenchAI. If you want to email me, LinkedIn, we check LinkedIn regularly. I have multiple people helping me do that one. So I get that one the most. Yeah.
I really want to appreciate your time. I know you spent more than an hour with me. I really appreciate it.
No, my pleasure. Didn't even notice. So thank you kindly. Appreciate it.
Do you have anything to add? Did we cover everything you wanted to cover?
Yeah, no. I think you're quite the pleasant individual. And I had a great
time. Same here. I feel the same.
I want to know more. I'll follow up after. Because let me formulate a few more questions, just because again, like I studied a bit of just international business and just kind of cross border stuff. It's always been fascinating. And it's always such a cool and interesting subject. I think it's one of those things that passes by and not enough people notice enough how ridiculously big its impact is on their life. Right.
Yeah, that's right.
The more we get connected, the more it becomes more important. So
to get on the call with you after the podcast at your any time, if you want to like have another conversation, we'll be happy to do that.
Awesome. Thanks, Robin. I appreciate it.
For the audience, I want to really wrap up this Localization Fireside Chat episode by thanking Dan for being part of this conversation. It was an honor to meet him and to have a conversation with him and to explain to us what Wrench.ai does. I want to thank you for the conversation. You generally reframed some of things for me, and I suspect for a lot of people who are listening today as well, you put things in the perspective for us. You can find this episode on YouTube, obviously, if you're joining us on the YouTube channel at l10nfiresidechat.com. And for those of you who are wondering, L10N, what does that mean? The word localization is 10 words, starts with an L. And it's a 10 word. And the last word is N. The last letter is N. So l10n@firesidechat.com. That's the YouTube handle. And we now have an app. You can look up the app, app.l10nfiresidechat.com. And you can have it on, you can add it to your mobile where you can see all the content. You don't have to figure out on Google where to find each episode, etc. They're all now sitting and I have them here on my phone. You can see the app on your phone. You can load your you can go through the podcast. You can read, listen, watch, whatever you prefer. All the videos are available. So thank you so much for joining me on this recording, and I will see you at the next one. Thank you. Appreciate it.